You're listening to the best of the day.
I say you and you the best.
Halford and Brough.
On a Wednesday. Happy Wednesday, everybody. Halford Brough, Sportsnet 650. Halford and Brough of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. At this point, I also need to mention our good friends, the Vancouver Canadiens. Yes, that's right. The C's are back at the Nat. For tickets or info, visit CanadiansBaseball.com and we will see you at the Nat. With a foot-long hot dog and an ice-cold beer. That music can only mean one thing. It's time now for Wish Wednesday. Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I like how you said you have to mention, like, there's a large man tapping a bat in his open hand in the corner of the studio.
He's wearing a Mountie hat, and he's looking very sternly at me.
Being like, you better do the ad read, Buster.
And I followed suit.
Do the read. Do the read.
Hey, Wish, we decided that we would leave the majority of the New York Rangers Carolina Hurricanes analysis to you. We spent a large part of this morning talking about the Battle of Alberta. First and foremost, have you been at the majority of the games that are in New York? Are you covering this one live in person?
Yeah, for sure. Last night I didn't because we were up in Bristol for what we thought was going to be our show last night, but due to circumstances that I'm sure all Canadians are aware of, it wasn't really a time for jokey, laughy hockey shows. So I covered that one remotely, but I've been on site in New York for all of their home games the last two rounds, and I'm actually heading to Raleigh tonight for game five of the let me rephrase that. I'm heading to Raleigh tonight for the Hurricanes' victory, and then I will head back to New York for the Rangers' victory. And then we'll head back to Raleigh to see who wins Game 7.
Okay, you open the door for this line of questioning. Why is it that the Carolina Hurricanes cannot win a game on the road?
You mean, why is it that the Carolina Hurricanes are the Carolina Hurricanes in Raleigh and the Hartford Whalers on the road?
Yes.
Very good question. you know, I think part of it, obviously, in the previous series at least, was their ability to get the line matchups that they wanted. I think that was really an issue in the Boston series when the Bergeron line would neutralize the Aho line. And then conversely, they couldn't get the Jordan Staal line out against the Bergeron line like they were able to in Raleigh. And it became a real key to the series, the line matching bit of it. I think that's less vital in this series. I think they've gotten maybe, I'd have to check the numbers, but I think they've gotten Staal out a little bit more against the Zibanejad line in this series. And it really hasn't mattered. And I'm fast. They definitely play with more pace and play with more physicality at home. There's a bit of a jolt that the crowd gives them that they don't have on the road. I think the weirdest thing about the series so far was game four, where, you know, game three, they were right in it. I thought they were right in the fight. They were maybe one shot away from really maybe even winning that game. I thought game four, they allowed the Rangers to carry play at 5-on-5 in a way that you would not expect that to happen based on what we know about these two teams and what we've seen metrically from these two teams. So that's a bit of a disturbing part of it. And then, obviously, the other disturbing part of it, if you're Carolina, is Igor Shesterkin has become unbeatable in the series. You know, he stopped 73 of 75 shots in the two games at Madison Square Garden. And you know, we've long said this is the guy who could take over a series, even though it didn't look like it in Pittsburgh. And that might be happening right now. So a few signs of trouble for the Hurricanes as they head back home. But they head back home where they've been unbeatable.
Are you surprised? I know you kind of briefly mentioned this. Are you surprised at all that the Hurricanes haven't been able to dominate from a possession standpoint? Even going back to the beginning of game one, and that was in Carolina, the Rangers came out and played really well. And I can't remember what the shot clock was, but it was heavily in favor of the New York Rangers. The Carolina Hurricanes ultimately pulled out the 2-1 win in overtime. But I guess just after watching Carolina all season and seeing the quality of that team and then also watching the Rangers against the Penguins and the Rangers for most of the season just leaning on Shesterkin. Like, don't get me wrong, Shesterkin has been good in this series, but I don't think he's been in the entire story.
No, but I mean, he's been good. like when the margins are small and your goalie is doing everything he needs to do to win a series, I think he's, for me, he's been the difference maker in the series so far. Even though he's not had to be, you know, Dominik Hasek back there or anything as far as like facing 80 shots every game. So game one, I felt like Carolina just didn't get to their game until the third period. And then when they did, they just rolled them. It's just a bad start. The other two games, I thought they got the better of 5-on-5 play and the better possession. Last night was weird. Like I said, they didn't play to their game. They got down early and handed a couple of power plays to the Rangers, and it felt like maybe that knocked them on their heels and they weren't really able to get to their game because of that deficit, and knowing with a 2-0 deficit, it was going to be really hard to rally because of the way that Shishkin was playing. So last night was the first time, to speak to your point, that I think it looked like that. I think the rest of the series, they've looked like Carolina outside of a couple periods where they just didn't answer the bell. And they might look like Carolina again in game five. I mean, they've been a different team on home ice, but you know, I think if anything, if you don't believe it's the Shesterkin series, then maybe it speaks to what some Ranger fans were saying, which is that the addition of Kopp and Braun and Mott after the trade deadline really solidified some things for them at 5-on-5, and they've been trending upwards in that spot.
Is Andrew Kopp the best acquisition from the trade deadline?
Well, it sure ain't Claude Giroux, I can say that.
No, it's not.
Oh, actually, that's not fair. Giroux had a really good game in their elimination game against Washington. I was making a real cheap joke. The answer, obviously, is Ben Chiarot is the worst acquisition at the trade deadline. And you know what? And I said he'd be the worst acquisition at the trade deadline, and he was the worst acquisition at the trade deadline. No, Kopp's been great, and so great that I think it makes for an interesting conversation about where the Rangers are going to go in the offseason, because – Ryan Strome needs a new contract. Andrew Kopp needs a contract. I think clearly the acquisition of Kopp was made with an eye towards beyond the season, like beyond being a rental. And his play in the playoffs and in the regular season, I think, has only solidified that. I think he's going to get paid and quite handsomely by the Rangers, which makes for an interesting conversation about what they'll end up doing with Strome, who, you know, his claim to fame, his calling card is playing with Panarin and doing it well. It's almost like in baseball when you have one catcher that catches your ace really well. You know what I mean? Like, you got to keep that guy around to catch the guy. But in this case, I mean, you know, it becomes a monetary thing, and you wonder whether or not Strome might get squeezed out with the amount of money that they're going to give Kopp and a few other guys.
Only one game in the NHL tonight. That is St. Louis and Colorado. The series could end tonight in Colorado. I'm still shaking my head at how the Blues tried to handle the Nazem Kadri situation and how they failed so spectacularly. It was just a complete loss of composure. And also, oh yeah, Kadri had a hat trick on them. And there have been very few times where such a nemesis has gone into the home arena and embarrassed the team like that. I don't know how the Blues recover from this. What did you make of how the Blues played game four?
Well, they don't recover, first of all. There's no way they're taking three games off of Colorado with Philly, Husso, and Nett the way he's playing. And also giving Colorado just multitudes of possession and chances and allowing them to control the game. I mean, there was one game in the series that I thought was proof of concept for St. Louis being able to win the series, and that was game two, I believe it was, where they took it to them. I mean, like, they look every bit like the team that could win the series. And then, you know, they looked like that for about 6 minutes of game three, and then Binnington got hurt, and then the whole house of cards kind of fell apart. They all said the right things after that game. Like, it's not about one guy, you know, we're going to focus on the team, yada, yada, yada. And then, like you said, the minute in which they had a chance to get a shot in on Kadri, they dogpiled him, right? they took two idiotic penalties, and then, you know, they didn't score on the 5-on-3, but they scored immediately after, and of course it was Kadri who scored. I picked the Blues in the series. We talked about it, and I will put an asterisk next to that pick because I truly believe that they would win this series if Binnington didn't get hurt. I truly do. Like, I think they played extraordinarily well in game two. You could see the difference between the way they play with Binnington and Nett and the way they play with Husso and Nett, insofar as when you have Binnington back there who's able to handle the puck, when you have Binnington back there that you know you can depend on, it allows you to get more into the offensive flow. And then you can watch, you watch the way they played at the beginning of game four, where they know, A, they've got a goalie who's not playing very well back there, and B, you have a goalie that can't play the puck very well back there. And it's no surprise they only had six shots on goal, I think it was, in the first period. You know, they scored a goal, but they only had six shots on goal. So once that injury happened, it just they unraveled. And you know, I don't know what kind of black magic the Avalanche have been practicing to have consecutive series in which the starting goaltender on which the opposing team builds their entire, you know, building on, gets injured. But prayers up for Mike Smith next round.
If it's Avs versus Oilers, how many of the top 10 players in the NHL on your personal list would be playing in that series?
Yeah, I saw that tweet. I think it was your tweet last night. You mentioned that, right? And I didn't really put that together. But yeah, I mean, it's at least, well, I mean, we start with four, right?
Yeah.
And you can kind of like go to Rantanen if you think you're high on him and maybe he gets to five. I don't think I'm missing anybody on the Oilers side. So, I mean, it might be like potentially half the guys, maybe.
Yeah.
It's an incredible series. And, you know, the thing about what we're watching with Connor right now is, I hearken back to maybe Mario as the last guy that has been able to exert his will on playoff games and playoff series in the manner in which Connor has, which of course makes Draisaitl Jager in the sense that like all he does is great stuff, but maybe not necessarily gets the same spotlight as the guy on the team that everybody focuses on, forever to be destined to Pippen to McDavid's Jordan. But it's going to be a fascinating series. I think for all of the excitement that we have about the way that their stars are playing and for all of the nail-biting tension that comes along with Mike Smith, who is going to be the focus of my column tomorrow. I cannot wait to write about Mike Smith. they can play pretty good hockey as a team. I think the Jay Woodcroft trend that we saw when he took over that team of them being able to be a sneakily good and effective defensive team has bled over to the playoffs. I think it's an underrated aspect of the series that they've been able to handle the Flames' best players as well as they have. I don't think it's necessarily these guys are choking. I think it's also what the Oilers are doing against them. And I think that I'm very confident the Tampa Bay Lightning are going to play for the Stanley Cup. Let me put it that way. I am very not confident as to who will emerge from a Colorado-Edmonton series.
How likely is it that Evander Kane is playing for a different team next season?
I would say it's not likely, right? I mean, like, I'm wondering whether or not contract structure maybe ultimately determines what this guy looks for.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, if you're the Oilers and you want to keep him hungry and you don't want to maybe make the same mistake that the Sharks did, like maybe you give him a deal that's more commensurate to a friendly term. And then it's on Evander to figure out if he'd want to do that or if there's someone else out there that offers him much more financial security, which for Evander Kane, I'm sure, is probably the optimum thing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested to see exactly what the market is for him and what he wants to end up doing. I mean, if I were him, I'd play with Connor in perpetuity. Like, why leave?
Right.
But I would imagine they'd want him back, especially just because of the constant need and want for guys that can play with your elite talent. Now the bigger question is, like, I don't think anybody but Connor is winning the Conn Smythe for the Oilers, but it would be interesting if like Evander Kane had like an historic amount of goals in the playoffs.
Right.
Like how the voters handle that. Cause I know the voters and I don't think they'd handle it very well.
Yeah. Wow. Connor's going to get it anyway. So let's talk
about that. Cause you know, I don't know if you know this, boys, but a plank in my platform is, I talked about this with Merrick last week, is that the Conn Smythe Trophy is for playoff MVP, unlike the other sports where it's for the finals MVP.
Yep. Mm.
Give me Oilers losing seven games. Give me McDavid with a country mile separating him from the rest of the scoring pack. And give me a conversation about how Connor McDavid should be the Conn Smythe winner, no matter if the Oilers are in the final or not.
Well, thank God the Oilers lost is the first thing that I will say.
In this mythical scenario you've dreamed up, that's the best part. You know what? Yeah. That would be fantastic from a breaking the brains of the Professional Hockey Writers Association, because, I mean, I'm trying to remember in NHL history, outside of a goalie, someone that's been able to pull the feat, right? It's just, it's so rare. And... Yeah. But again, you bring up a really good point, because I think a lot of people do overlook that in the other sports, it is the final series MVP, not the MVP of the entire playoffs. Those are two fundamentally different conversations.
But more weight is always given to the actual Stanley Cup finals, whether it's intentional or not.
It is.
Yeah, except for 2003, where Jagr had three great rounds.
Correct.
And crapped the bed in the final and still
right.
won Conn Smythe in a losing effort. Now, not that I'm a Devils fan or anything.
Not that you're bitter about
it. Not that you remember that sort of stuff.
No, but here's the thing. So Forsberg led the league in scoring in 2002. The Avalanche didn't play in the final. Couture, I think, was third in 1 year for the Sharks. They didn't make the final. Gabrick is the best example for me for a lot of years, where it was the same postseason as Jagr. And Gabrick was, like, again, by a country mile, the best scorer on the Wild during their run to the conference final that year. So there have been some instances of guys that you could point to and say, these guys were by far the most valuable players to their team. But it just, you know, it's become sort of de facto. I mean, it's never happened, right? So it's like tradition that you don't even look at the previous three rounds and the teams that are not playing in the final. We have to give the MVP to someone in the final. And it's funny, it doesn't work like that all the time in international tournaments. Like the Olympics, you can have an MVP that's not in the gold medal game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird to me always that, you know, we have this default setting of, we've got to pick somebody in the final. Well, maybe you don't. Maybe if Connor McDavid is the reason why the Oilers go to, like, the conference final and play really well there but fall short, like, I defy you to find it someone, and maybe the only guy would be Vasilevskiy. I defy you to find anybody on, like, Tampa or Colorado that is going to be as valuable to their team as McDavid was to the Oilers. It just won't happen. So if we're going to ever have a conversation about one of these convoluted things your boy is always theorizing about, it might be the year to have it.
You're kind of nibbling around the edges of the Erik Karlsson situation from a few years back, are you not? Didn't someone actually vote for him for Conn Smythe, despite him and the Ottawa Senators not getting to the final? I think it was 2017.
What a brave soul that is.
Yeah.
To do that. Yeah, it should happen. Again, there's nothing in the rules that say a dog can't play basketball. There's nothing in the rules that says you can't vote for somebody outside of the final for Conn Smythe. It's the nature of the rule. And you guys know I'm a Hart Trophy strict constructionist. I am a Conn Smythe strict constructionist. You can obviously pick anybody in the playoffs to be the MVP. I will say, again, I'll meet you halfway. Like, I'm not saying you should pick somebody who lost in seven games in the first round and say that's the playoff MVP. They probably have to make the conference final for this to be a thing. But I'd have no problem if you pick somebody from a conference final and said, you know, the rest of the team was dragged there by this one player, and henceforth they should be MVP. I think that's only a logical thing to say.
I don't want to sound like we're horse trading here, but I will support your platform if you support my platform that defensemen need to start getting more love in the Hart Trophy race.
I think that's fair, but like who like,
you know, just in general, The seasons that some of the defensemen are having or had this season, whether it's Roman Josi or Cale Makar, or this goes back, you know, years when these defensemen have this terrific season. And not only do they not become finalists, they don't even seem to be in the conversation. And I just think we sit here over and over in Vancouver and talk about the value of defensemen and the value of a number one defenseman and how valuable Quinn Hughes is to the team. And the Canucks have never had a guy like this before. And yet the MVP of the league never seems to be a defenseman, and a defenseman never seems to be even in the conversation.
Well, 2 decades since somebody's won it, right? Pronger back in 2000.
Yeah. So I'm down for that. Cause I think again, like, much like goalies have the Vezina, you know, defensemen have the Norris. The voters vote for the Norris. They don't vote for the Vezina. And I'm sure there's probably a sense of, like, they've got their own award. It's the same thing with the Cy Young and pitchers in baseball, right? Like, you can't pitcher doesn't win MVP because the pitcher has their own award. And so,
yeah, but like, a forward has the Art Ross, really, except
well,
in the odd year
Ross,
that Bobby Orr won.
But the Art Ross is a trophy of achievement, like statistical achievement. The other ones are subjective. But I'm just telling you, I think that's, as a voter, that's why defensemen don't win the Hart more, is because I think it's because they have their own award. That said, there's nothing you said that's incorrect. I mean, like, they play more than forwards.
Mm-hmm.
They frequently play a more vital role than forwards because they are tasked with, you know, I mean, look at Victor Hedman. Like, he's tasked with being the defensive stopper, right? He plays like 24 to 25 minutes a night, and he's tasked with being an offensive force for them. And he does both extraordinarily well. And so I agree with you, man. Like, I feel like defensemen have long been overlooked for the MVP. And I don't know what we want from him. I mean, like, you know, Roman Josi's put together one of the best offensive seasons we've seen from a defenseman in 30 years. And I'm not even, you know, he wasn't the finalist. I don't even know if he finished in the top five. So I can support that for the right defenseman, especially just because it's become a de facto forward award. Goalies and defensemen unions unite and march on NHL headquarters demanding equal Hart treatment.
Wish, we just got a couple minutes left here. Where do the Florida Panthers go from here?
Well, you know, I talked to some people around that team before the playoffs, and the sense I got was that they were ready to extend Brunette. They were ready to give him a multi-year extension. Obviously, the regular season went incredibly well. And so my question about him is, winning a playoff round, which is, again, something the franchise had not done since 1996, so it is a big deal that they did, and then getting your lunch handed to you by a two-time Stanley Cup champion and arguably the best coach in the sport, where do you go from there? Like, is the Tampa series enough to say this guy can't get it done because when adversity really hit, they couldn't figure themselves out? Do they look at what happened to the offensive system and say there's something malfunctioning here where they don't know how to modulate what they do for playoff hockey? And you know, can another coach crack that code? It'll be interesting to see where they go with it. I honestly don't know, because I think that they were prepared for Brunette to be that guy. And I've already seen Barkov this morning say they want him back.
Yep.
So it's, I don't know, man. You're messing with something pretty good, that based on regular season record, based on, you know, gutting out that win against the Capitals. It's funny how, like, the Lightning have put two teams into a crisis of conscience, and the Leafs have already said, we're not going to overreact because we lost to a dynastic team. And I wonder if Florida ends up in the same spot philosophically.
Wish, great stuff today, man. Thanks a lot for doing this. We really appreciate it. Enjoy all the games this week and this weekend. We'll do this again next Wednesday.
Anytime. Thanks.
Thank you. Greg Wyshynski from ESPN here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Okay, we got a lot more to get to on the program coming up. One of our favorite guests on the Halford and Brough Show, Stephen Brunt, acclaimed author, host of his own show, Fan 590 in Toronto. Warning, there will be some Canadian Football League talk.
But we're also going to talk about the Battle of Alberta.
Yep.
And maybe talk about some of Stephen's memories of the old Battle of Alberta and how this one might be one of the wildest series that we've seen in the playoffs in quite a while. And it is an all-Canadian one that we've all been looking forward to.
Speaking of the Battle of Alberta, 8 o'clock hour, Rick Ball from the Calgary side of things, Jack Michaels from the Edmonton side of things as we dive deep into the Stanley Cup playoffs. A reminder, there's only the one game tonight. It is St. Louis and Colorado. The Avs are looking to close out the series against the Blues at Ball Arena in Denver. That one goes tonight. So we got a lot more to get to on the program. Brunt coming up in the next hour. And then in the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to go Battle of Alberta heavy with Jack Michaels and Rick Ball. It's a big show. Your job as a listener is to not go anywhere and keep it on the dial. The Halford and Brough Show, Sportsnet 650.
You're listening to the best of the day.
I said you the best.
Halford and Brough.
6:52 on a Wednesday. Halford and Brough, Sportsnet 6:50. Halford and Brough of the Morning is brought to you by the Dilawri family of Acura dealers. Experience the Dilawri difference today by visiting your nearest Dilawri Acura dealer today. Hour one of the program in the books. Terrific hit with Greg Wyshynski as we relitigated how NHL awards are voted on and their classifications. Kudos to the one guy or gal, who knows, who texted in, "No one cares about NHL awards. Give it a break." To which I replied, LOL. You kill him with kindness, laddie. You kill him with kindness. Also, non-engaging content is how you kill them. Anyway, hour one is in the books. Download it now. You can also hear me completely goof on Jason's really good question asking, in the upcoming Colorado-Edmonton series, and yes, we're penciling both teams in, how many of the top 10 players in the NHL are going to be in that series? To which I replied, well, what about Hedman and Kucherov? They're not going to be in that series at all. They play for Tampa Bay.
It's because you didn't get your coffee.
I got it now.
You finally got it.
I hacked the, by one, the work coffee machine is back up and functional.
I know. It wasn't working yesterday, and I had to drink tea.
Yeah.
English breakfast.
It didn't go great for
you?
I was like,
can I get some fried tomatoes with this?
Some beans in my coffee?
Yeah.
Anyway.
And, oh, make sure it's a little bit cold.
Yeah, the work coffee is oddly cold. This is all a big preamble, by the way, to tell you that we are now in the midst of hour two, the Halford and Brough Show. This hour of Halford and Brough is brought to you by North Star Metal Recycling. Vancouver's premier metal recycler pays the highest prices on scrap metal. North Star Metal Recycling, they recycle, you get paid. Visit them at 1170 Powell Street in Vancouver. Do we have Steven on the line now? Joining us now, author for Sportsnet.ca. You hear him on Fan 590 in Toronto. Steven Brunt here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. Good morning, Steven. How are you?
Hey, guys. I'm good. How are you?
We're good, thanks. Jason, where do you want to start here? Do we want to start Battle of Alberta? Or do we want to start Canadian Football League labor strife?
Oh, let's go with something exciting, actually, and interesting, and that would be the Battle of Alberta. Steven, game one, I think we all watched that and went, well, that was interesting. I'm not sure if that's going to be the rest of the series, but apparently it is the rest of the series. Game one has pretty much just carried over, just in terms of the wildness of the series, the unpredictability, and, oh, yeah, the terrible goaltending. It's almost cliche now to say, well, I guess the 80s are back since the Battle of Alberta. What have you been thinking while you've been watching this crazy series?
I've been enjoying it along with everybody else. It is great to be able to watch the series as a neutral. And I know nobody in Alberta on this one is a neutral, but everybody else in Canada maybe is a, you know, pretty neutral on this. Just to sit there and soak it in and just watch it for pure entertainment value, because it has been, you know, all this, everything you suggested, and, you know, plus the kind of the Connor McDavid coronation in the middle of it, although that storyline kind of departed a little bit last night. But yeah, lots of goals, terrible goaltending, back and forth, the worst goal in history last night, in the history of the playoffs last night, but the Oilers still win. And, you know, especially in games two and three, the idea that we might be watching one of the greatest players in the history of hockey finally having his playoff moments. So, yeah, that's a lot. You know, plus lots of good, honest hatred between the two cities, the classic rivalry stuff that's, you know, baked in there. It's way more fun than watching a game played in, you know, San Jose or St. Louis, or, you know, take your pick. There's something about it that you can watch it with, I say, decide whether you're cheering for the red team or the blue team, but that doesn't really matter. Just let it wash over you.
I am cheering for neither the Flames nor the Oilers, and I never will, but I have to admit I'm cheering for McDavid just because I think what we're seeing right now, I mean, it does bring me back to the days of Gretzky and Lemieux in terms of their dominance of the game, mm-hmm. and just how you watch McDavid play and you're like, that guy sticks out. Right, like, with all due respect to Sidney Crosby, like, one of the greatest hockey players I've ever seen, I don't think the separation between Sid and all the other players on the ice is quite to the extent of what McDavid is. Have you ever seen a player like McDavid in the NHL?
Well, you're into those. It's a short list, right? I've never seen a player exactly like him, because I, you know, when you think of the things he does and the things he does well and kind of the physical specimen that he is, he's a little, you know, but you'd say that about every, all of the Mount Rushmore players, you know, that they are, they're all different, aren't they? That, and I, you know, and I would put Sid on that list, and he's a different player, and he has lifted at times some not great supporting casts all the way to the Stanley Cup. So that's, you know, that it's, but there is a difference, I think. That, like, this reminds me, the closest thing for me is Mario. I just, and I know Mario and Connor McDavid are two different players, but in the ability to physically dominate, use his strength, but also with those incredibly, you know, refined, beautiful hockey skills that he has, that's kind of, to me, that's Mario like at his absolute peak, when every shift you knew he was out there, and every shift you watched him just impose his will. Now, again, not so much last night, and that's a really good Flames team, and I thought they were going to win the series going in. They're not done yet, but especially in the second and third games, I think everybody was just kind of breathtaking. And yeah, you can hate the Oilers all you want, but if you're a sports fan, I think when you get those chances to kind of step back and say, "Man, guys like this don't pass through all that often." And I might want to tell my grandchildren about this, that I was watching these games. And I think that's kind of where we were with Connor McDavid, or we are with Connor McDavid. You know, now, to complete that story, he's got to win this round, then he's got to win two more rounds and actually hoist the cup at the end, because all of those other guys we're talking about did. But that's, yeah, I think that the penny kind of dropped for everybody the previous two games, saying, you know, this, man, maybe this is it finally, and maybe the story is not going to be how Edmonton is squandering the best years of Connor McDavid's career one more time, that Connor McDavid is the Mike Trout of hockey, that, you know, maybe he's so good now that, you know, and maybe he's got enough of a supporting cast that we're going to complete this and, you know, start chiseling his face into the mountainside.
Do you think it's weighed on him that, if you look at how all the things that Sid won before, I don't know, what was he, 23 or something, he'd won Stanley Cup, he was the hero at the Olympics, you look at Gretzky and Lemieux together, they had that 87 Canada Cup between them, they both, Gretzky certainly won Stanley Cups early on in his career, and I don't know how old Lemieux was when he finally won a Stanley Cup, but he was certainly around McDavid's age. Do you think that weighed on Connor McDavid, just the fact that he didn't even have the opportunity to play at the Olympics or the Canada Cup? Or I know he had that, you know, weird World Cup, but that doesn't count.
Yeah, that doesn't count. You mean the Young Guns won that one?
Yeah, he wasn't even on Team Canada.
Exactly. Everybody remembers that, don't they? It was so great. I'm not sure. Well, I don't know if the kind of weight of history was on him. I don't know if it was that, but I Lord knows, you'd have to be frustrated just with, you know, the continuing gong show that was the Oilers organization. That, you know, watching, like, how many coaches has he played for already? And, you know, general managers coming and going, and just the sense that the plan wasn't working out, the process wasn't working out, and he was doing what he could do, but I think that's got to be frustrating if you're, you know, a great player in a dysfunctional organization, which is what he was. Now, they may have figured it out now, you know, and whether people like it or not, part of the figuring out might have been deciding that they could live with Evander Kane for part of a season. But yeah, I would think, like, I don't know if guys think, man, I'm behind Sid, you know, on the clock here. I better win something, because it is a team achievement. You can only you only can play your shifts and do what you can. But I have to think that there have been seasons in his career where at the end of it, he looked around and said, man, what am I doing here?
So I was thinking about the Battle of Alberta and how I remember that as a kid in the 80s. And I guess the last one was in 1991. And then I also remembered how prominent the Canadian teams were in the NHL during the 80s. Like, it was, how did it go when Oilers won the Cup finally in 84. They won it again in 85. 86, the Habs won it. The Oilers won it in 87. They won it again in 88. The Flames won it in 89. The Oilers won it in 1990. And then a few years later, The Habs won it. And then no Canadian teams after that have won the Stanley Cup. I feel like we've discussed this with you on previous hits, but I actually don't think we talk about this enough. The fact that if a Canadian team doesn't win the Stanley Cup this year, and I suppose Edmonton still has a shot and so does Calgary, but it's against the odds. It'll be 30 years then. 30 years yeah. since a Canadian team won the Stanley Cup. And I don't know if there's a specific reason for it, if it's just a weird statistical thing. Certainly there have been Canadian teams that have had an opportunity to do it. I've seen the Vancouver Canucks play three games to win the Stanley Cup and lose them all. But I don't know. I mean, I wonder if we're just going to have some sort of like 30-year anniversary of this thing and we're going to celebrate this thing or mourn this thing. What do you make of it all?
Man, I hadn't even thought of that. That's because that's awful. It also makes me feel old because I, you know, pretty vivid memories of 93 and covering the playoffs that year. I honestly don't know what to make of it. You just think, so since then, the Canucks, the Senators, the Oilers, and the Flames all played in the finals, right? So there have been chances in the interim, some better than others, to win it. They got it close, but not, you know, that's not a lot in 30 years. I don't know if there's kind of a unifying theory here to say why playing on this side of the border makes it more difficult to compete. I honestly don't. I know people have had, like, I've heard folks, especially where I am, kind of espouse the idea that, you know, players in Canada, it's too comfortable playing in Canadian markets sometimes, that you're a hero walking down the street no matter what you do, and so you don't feel that pressure, that thumping pressure to get to the stand to win in the playoffs, to get to the Stanley Cup. I'm not sure that makes a whole lot of sense, to be honest. And organizationally, you've had great coaches working in Canada over the years, guys who won Stanley Cups other places. You have plenty of them. Smart organizations, you know, less smart organizations sometimes too, and less smart coaches. But it's not a, you know, there's it's not something that happens when you cross the border. You suddenly get dumber or worse. So yeah, but you kind of feel it, I think, in a moment like this, don't you? When you're watching this, like I like the, what we have now is we have a Canadian team conference final.
Yep.
Which we also had last year,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, second year in a row.
Because I didn't even mention the Habs getting the finals last year, which, you know, I've kind of forgotten that whole season, or happily forgotten that whole weird season that we went through last year. But, yeah, so you have a Canadian team going to the conference final. This year it feels not weird like it did last year, where it was a, kind of that hothouse in the Canadian division, and you knew one of them had to get through, and one of the worst teams in the division did get through. Whoever comes out of this Edmonton Calgary series is going to be at least a live dog going in against Colorado. I think, you know, that now that you mention it, you kind of this is the moment when that kind of sinks in, that, you know, maybe one of these teams has a shot this year. They're going to have to be two really, really good teams in the last two rounds to get through. But wouldn't it be something? And maybe, one of the things that's funny is that the notion that Canadians will all rally around that, they won't. We've seen that. Like, when the Canucks were in the finals, did the rest of Canada rally around the Canucks? No. No, they didn't. Or the Senators, or even the Oilers, or even the Habs last year. There was no real, oh boy, well, that's not my team, but they're doing it for Canada. We break down regionally and locally in hockey, all of our allegiances.
And I think that's maybe the way it should be. I like it. Like, if you go over to the Premier League, like, I don't think, you know, Manchester United supporter, they're in the same city. I don't think they're like so happy that City pulled it out.
Yeah, and I don't think
that's good for the City, right?
City fans aren't cheering for Liverpool this weekend. Like, it doesn't work.
Yeah,
like
that's
that.
Right. I say that they're not going to be cheering for Liverpool this weekend, are they? So that, exactly. But maybe the McDavid thing changes that a little bit. I kind of think the idea that, like I know lots of, you know, people in Calgary and Vancouver and Winnipeg hated Gretzky because he came in and just wrecked their hopes all the time. But I think there might be a little rally round if it's McDavid in the final. You know, that
possibly. I can see it. Like,
kind of happen.
I'm cheering for McDavid, so I guess I'd be happy for him. I just kind of like to maybe get to the finals and play some huge games, because he's never played really huge games. If you want to call these huge games, fine, but it's still the second round of the playoffs. But I think what overrides it for me and a lot of our listeners, no, not everyone agrees, is the fact that whoever breaks this drought is going to have the greatest party. Like, it will be in North American sports history. Like, we've seen some crazy parties. Like, when the Cubs won the World Series, that was insane. When the Red Sox won the World Series and broke their curse, that was insane. But I don't know if anything will stack up to the first Canadian team to win the Stanley Cup in around 30 years. The celebration, the parade that will happen, the party that will happen, like, it is going to be unprecedented.
Be sort of like the party if the Leafs went around. It'd be exactly the same party.
Similar.
Yeah, it'd be exactly the same. Similar. Honest to God, yeah, the streets would have filled. But yeah, I think, like, in either of these two towns, well, we've what the scene looks like, and we've seen that during the Stanley Cup Finals, not in the not super distant past. So you know what the whole scene is going to look like. But yeah, I'm not sure what it'd be like. Because it just hasn't happened for so long. And, you know, you kind of, as you say, going back to 93, like, it wasn't that distant at that point.
It was expected then that a Canadian team, like, Montreal had, it's like, we turned over some cars and, like, we had a bit of a riot, but there was, like, we've done this before. We did it fairly recently. And it really is incredible that Gary Bettman, that was the first Stanley Cup he handed out as commissioner and has not handed one out to a Canadian team since then.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that were incredible about that, because that was also the year that, you know, Bruce McDowell was chairman of the Board of Governors of the National Hockey League in 1993. He's the guy that hired Gary Bettman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his team was in that finals, the Los Angeles Kings. And Bruce was, well, there may be another person, but Bruce was the only guy in the building that night that knew he was going to jail. So it's one of my favorite stretches of NHL history, all in all. I think the part about Bruce McDowell hiring Gary Bettman, they've erased from the big book of NHL history.
Now, Bruce McDowell also owned the Argos. That seems like a long time ago. With Gretzky and John Candy, that was a very unique ownership group. I want to talk about the CFL with you just for a sec. And I feel like we've bashed the CFL so much. I mean, Mike and I have, just like, anytime we're talking about the CFL, it's about their missteps. But what do you hype up about this league? Like, even if we were to try our very best to hype up the CFL, where would we go? What's great about the CFL right now?
Well, it's a tricky one. And I will do my normal disclaimer here, which is that though I live in a part of Central Canada where the CFL is, you know, not healthy,
mm-hmm.
Although healthier here in my hometown of Hamilton than it is down the road in Toronto. But if other than going to kind of playing the remember when card or the tradition card or the history and culture card, and I once had a beef with Roy McMurtry when he was the chairman of the CFL, mm-hmm. about this subject, where I wrote something critical of the league for some reason. There's always lots of reasons to do it, and he scolded me about, you know, history and culture and all of this stuff, and why didn't I respect it. And I said, no, back, said, look, it's not a museum. You know, this is not the Museum of Canadian Football. We don't all go and look at it behind a glass, you know, in a glass case and say, oh, isn't that lovely? That's what our forefathers enjoyed. And the history is fantastic. I wrote a book about the history of the Grey Cup. I love the history of the league and all that stuff, but that's not a marketing plan. It's just not, it's not a marketing plan saying this is good for you.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's important, so you should go watch it. So the way I would sell it, if I was in charge, would be, it's why you like football. The football is a very popular sport in North America. It's enormously popular on television. It's highly entertaining. If you don't like football, I'm not going to try and sell this to you. But for those of you who like football, this is on your doorstep. It's affordable. And embrace it the way you embrace MLS or the Canadian Premier League in soccer. We're going to make a soccer reference. You know, that's not Liverpool and Man City, but it doesn't matter because it's your local. So go out, have fun, watch football, a sport you like. This kind of football is slightly different than the other kind of football, but it's not that different. But I wouldn't sell it on the basis that saying, oh, the rules are better, because sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't, to be honest. Sometimes the rules work against this game. I wouldn't go and say, well, our players are actually, you know, better than people think they are. Well, No, you know, there's lots of great athletes in the league, but the best guys are going to play in that other league because they make way more money. So don't try and you know, and the you remember the Our Balls Are Bigger, you know, those kind of campaigns that they went through. That like no,
well
don't
even
do that
more, or even the argument that we still get sometimes is like the CFL is more exciting than the NFL. Since when?
But
like,
it's not. Did you,
it's not. No, it's not even close. Actually, the CFL product is part of the problem. I think the games have been tremendously boring. I think there's a serious lack of talent at quarterback.
Well, there is, and that's because, you know, back in the day they benefited from, you know, certain kind of quarterbacks skill-wise not being welcomed into the NFL, and also a certain kind of quarterback color-wise not being welcomed into the NFL. That, right. You know, that helped the CFL over the years. But that, yeah, that whole idea that, you know, the NFL football is 3 yards in a cloud of dust, like I think Bill Walsh changed that, you know, or maybe the Bengals, you know, back in the day changed that. Like, that hasn't been true for a million years. So, no, don't try and tell me that this is wide open playground football and that is predictable, boring football. You ever seen Patrick Mahomes? So that, yeah, that's a bad argument.
Any of the games in the NFL, have you watched a single one? Did you see
Chiefs
Bills?
It's a bad argument at this stage in history. And I think you sell it as this is your local. And it doesn't have to be something else. It's just, it is what it is, and enjoy it for what it is. And don't get defensive about it, and don't turn your nose up at it either. Because why? What's the point of that? That's the one thing, the kind of people saying, I wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. All I do is watch the NFL on TV on Sunday. Well, yeah, okay, but it's kind of joyless. You know?
It is.
I'd rather go to a game sometime.
And I try not to pile on the CFL because I love the CFL. I went to games as a kid growing up when BC Place was packed. I've traveled across to Grey Cups just for fun, just as a fan, not even media. My whole argument has been like celebrate the Canadian part of it, and it's why I've had such a big problem with Randy Ambrosi saying we need to think bigger, we need to think global. No, you need to think local. And I think this text that we just got in from Tim, the CFL needs to do the support local thing. Take pride and support your team just like you support your local coffee shop every day or pub every week. The hipsters of Canada will eat that up. I agree with that. Celebrate that. What is the game plan of the global ambition? What is the end plan of the global ambition of the CFL? I just, for the life of me, do not get it.
You know what I think? It's the illusion of growth. And I think that the idea that if you're not growing, especially in the CFL where you've had, you know, multiple bankruptcies over the last 30 years, the idea that the league was shrinking and always on the verge, we have an arrow pointing in a certain direction and we're going to get bigger, we're going to evolve, we're going to progress, you know, and I think maybe from a business point of view, I guess you need that. You can't, stasis is probably not that sexy, but I think whether you can sell local in terms of the like, people don't have any connection to university football in this country, which is unfortunate. They just don't. I can show you the TV numbers from the last time it was on nationally. Nobody watched. Like, nobody. Would have been cheaper for – we did it. It would have been cheaper for us to send a $20 bill to everybody watching the game rather than actually broadcast it. In the grassroots football, that's a tough connection to make. And I say this – like, I like CIS football. I watch CIS football. But the idea of kind of rally around, and just, I say, the idea of a local. You guys know soccer. If you're in the old country and, you know, you go to Old Trafford or Emirates or one of those, and that's your, you also probably have a small side in the championship or one of the, you know, or even one of the low leagues way below that, where you go out and there's 1,500 people standing in the rain watching a game. You know, you can have both. They can coexist.
Mike has always been a big Swindon Town guy, so that's his. That's
there
his,
you go.
See,
local,
the beautiful thing for me is that my small pittance of a club is also the one that's barely hanging alive in the Premier League, so it works perfectly. I have a really tiny club that I get to support all the time.
His is Leeds. Mine was bought by Saudi Arabia. Yeah. Mine is Newcastle.
Bit of a difference financially.
Bit of a difference there.
Yeah, that whole. I'd be very interested to talk to hardcore Geordie's supporters of Newcastle United about the mixed feelings you must have now that Saudi Arabia kept your team up and is going to
99% of them love it because they've been so damaged by the Mike Ashley era. Anyway, we could probably talk some more soccer, but we got to let you go, Stephen. Thanks for joining us. Another great chat.
All right, guys. Talk soon.
Stephen Brunt from Sportsnet.ca and, of course, on Fan 590 in Toronto. We got a lot to get to on the program. Laddie has found some juicy audio, it appears, that we could tease for the upcoming segment because we have an open segment here on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650. According to him, keeping his ear to the ground in the goalie world, Fried just throwing it out there that the Florida Panthers are looking to move on from Sergei Bobrovsky.
My word. Apparently they already shopped him at the deadline and still aren't impressed with how he's performed.
So we'll dive into that and a bunch of other stories around the NHL. Torts has resurfaced as the Philadelphia Flyers look for their new head coach. There's a lot of stories going on around the NHL. We will dive into them next on the Halford and Brough Show on Sportsnet 650.